Yesterday we talked a little bit about, and this is before we get to my presentation, we talked a little bit about Revelation 13:8, and I misunderstood what the question was. I'll confess the reason I misunderstood what the question was is because the problem with being the last speaker is through everybody's speech, you're half listening to their speech and half thinking about what you're going to say. So I thought the question had to do with whether or not the verb slain or the participle slain went with the lamb. Well, that's kind of obvious, I guess. It obviously does. You don't have to look at the Greek to see that. But I went back later and looked at the ESV, and I realized what the question was. It's whether or not from the foundation goes with the lamb being slain or not. There's absolutely no reason whatsoever that from the foundation cannot go with the verb written. And that's the way I would translate it. It's not required to go with written. As far as the grammar is concerned, it could go either way. But for semantic reasons and contextual reasons, I would strongly favor connecting it with written, not that I'm the one who decides that. Let's get to our lesson today. I really appreciate this forum. It's a forum in which I can feel confident that I can present my material, and some of you will disagree very strongly with maybe some of what I say, maybe much of what I say, maybe many of you will. Cal will probably take it all apart. But we'll discuss it, and afterwards you'll still love me, and when we see each other next year, we'll all be glad to see each other. And very sincerely, I appreciate that about how this is put together. I'm going to spend my time talking with you about Leviticus chapter 17 and 18 this afternoon. And I'm going to especially focus on the relationship between Leviticus 17 and 18 and the Jerusalem letter in Acts 15, and also some connections, some real and some imagined, between the Jerusalem letter and 1 Corinthians 5, 1 Corinthians 8 through 10, and Matthew chapter 19. First of all, what I think I want to do is just establish the connection between the Jerusalem letter and Leviticus 17 and 18. In Leviticus 17 and 18, you have, first of all, a discussion in chapter 17 in the first nine verses about bringing their sacrifice to the doorway of the tent of meeting. And then you have instructions about not eating blood, and then about bleeding an animal. And then you get into chapter 18, and there's some things said about remembering the lifestyle of Egypt. Don't do that. Don't live the way the people of the Canaanite or the people who live in Canaan live. And then you have a whole slew of sexual sins described, and these are forbidden. And then it concludes at the end of chapter 18 with an observation that the peoples of the land that you're going to inhabit have been driven out of the land or are going to be driven out of the land because they did these things. We look at Acts, the 15th chapter, and we see the Jerusalem letter includes four prohibitions. They're to abstain from things sacrificed to idols. Well, if we go back and we look at the first nine verses of Leviticus 17, we have in verse 3, any man from the house of Israel who slaughters an ox or a lamb or a goat in the camp or who slaughters it outside the camp and has not brought it to the doorway of the tent of meeting to present it as an offering to the Lord before the tabernacle, blood guiltiness is upon him. And the reason is given in verse 5. The reason is so that the sons of Israel may bring their sacrifices, which they were sacrificing in the open field, that they may bring them into the Lord. And then in verse 7, we find that this is a measure to prevent idolatry. They shall no longer sacrifice their sacrifices to the goat demons with which they play the harlot. So we can summarize that and say it's really about idolatry. The second prohibition in the Jerusalem letter is against, or it's a command to abstain from blood. And of course we get into Leviticus chapter 17 verses 10 through 12, and we are reminded that the life is in the blood, not to eat the blood. The third provision of the Jerusalem letter is that they're to abstain from things strangled. And in Leviticus the 17th chapter verse 13, when any man in hunting catches a beast or a bird which may be eaten, he shall pour out its blood and cover it with earth. You bleed your animal. Of course, this is connected with the idea of eating blood. And there's probably a lot to be said here about covering it with earth. It would go back to really some of Kevin's topic earlier. But for our purposes, I want to simply focus on the fact that this talks about really proper slaughtering. and improper slaughtering. And that's related to the idea of things strangled in the Jerusalem letter. And then finally, there is the command to abstain from fornication in the Jerusalem letter. And that gets us to Leviticus chapter 18, where we have all those sexual sins, of all sorts of sexual sins being described. So, is Leviticus 17, 18 the basis of the letter? Well, what I've just laid out is that the order corresponds. You have the same topics addressed in the same order. The very four items that you see in Acts 15, verse 29, laid out in the same order as they occur in Leviticus 17 and 18. To be sure, back in verse 20 or 21, when James first proposes the letter and itemizes the four topics, he does so in a different order. He says things, he says pollutions of idol, to abstain from pollutions of idols, and then fornication, and then things strangled, and then blood. But when they put pen to paper, they put them in the order that they are found in Leviticus 17 and 18. And that makes sense to me. If you're extemporaneously trying to recall or mentioning things that are listed in some document, you mention them in the order that you remember them. But if you go then to write this up, you're going to look at that document and put them in the order in which they are in the document. The second thing that helps me to conclude that Leviticus 17 and 18 lies behind the Jerusalem letter is the applicability to Gentiles. The letter in Jerusalem, that's its express audience, is to write to the Gentiles. And what we'll see in Leviticus 18 is that the things in view there were things that were applicable to Gentiles. In Leviticus 18, after we've gone through all of these sins, chapter 18, verse 24 says, "For by all these, the nations which I'm casting out before you have become defiled." God held them accountable for these things. In chapter 18, verse 25, "Therefore I have brought its punishment upon it, so that the land has spewed out its inhabitants." Why are they being cast out of the land? Because they did these things and polluted the land. In verse 27, "For the men of the land who have been before you have done all these abominations, and the land has become defiled." Now the question arises, what is included in all these? When it says in verse 27, they've done all these abominations, what is included? Is it just the prior verse or the prior two verses? Is it just the sexual sins of chapter 18? Does it go back and include the improper slaughtering of chapter 17? Does it go back and include eating blood? Does it go all the way back and include idolatry? Does it go all the way back to the beginning of Leviticus and include a whole bunch of things? In the outline, I make an argument that basically is this. I try to establish that Leviticus 17 and 18 is a section unto itself. And the way that I tried to establish that is by arguing that Leviticus 16 is the Day of Atonement. It has nothing to do with Leviticus 17 and 18. Clear break. And then in Leviticus 19, we have various laws, including things that are obviously peculiar to Israel. For example, laws about the Sabbath and about mixing seed and about mixing different kinds of fabric in a garment. I don't think any of us believe those things pertained to the pagans, to the Gentiles. So my argument was, well, you see Leviticus 17 and 18 is a section unto itself, so when it says all these abominations, it's including all four of those things. I hereby reject that argument. And let me explain why. Look at, I had to take myself down, so you just beat you to the punch. Look at Leviticus chapter 18 and verse 3. "You shall not do what is done in the land of Egypt where you lived, nor are you to do what is done in the land of Canaan where I am bringing you. You shall not walk in their statutes." What I want you to notice is the reference to the things that are done by the Canaanites. After that, you have all this discussion of sexual sin, and then the chapter ends with verse 27, "For the men of the land who've been before you have done all these abominations." I think those two serve as bookends. Don't do what the Canaanites do. Don't do all these things. Don't commit all these sexual sins. The men of the land did these things. I think that kind of serves as bookends to say that what's in view when it says all these things is the list of sexual sins in Leviticus 18. However, it's clear enough to us that idolatry is something that God holds all men accountable for. In Romans chapter 1, all men who have worshipped the creature rather than the creator are held accountable by God. It's clear enough that eating blood was something prohibited to all men. We can go back to Genesis, the 9th chapter, and when God first of all gave man permission to eat flesh, he said, "Don't eat the blood. The life is in the blood." Said this to Noah, the father of all men. And of course, then the proper slaughtering or the bleeding of animals would just be part and parcel of that. And so I think it's fair enough to say that even though all these things at the end of chapter 18 is probably referring specifically to the sexual sins of chapter 18, really, in principle, if not in specific method of application, in principle, the prohibitions of Leviticus 17 and 18 were things that God held all men accountable for. And therefore, it's very natural for James to go back to this passage and look at the topics itemized there. And we'll discuss that more in a moment. I also would not doubt that the Holy Spirit has grouped all of these things together here in chapter 7 and 18, because we are talking about things for which God has held all men accountable. The third reason that I believe that we can conclude that Leviticus 17 and 18 is the basis for the Jerusalem letter has to do with how we interpret James' rationale. I understand what James says as the rationale for the letter to be a needed caveat due to the fact that it was understood Gentiles are familiar with the teachings of the law of Moses. Why would they be familiar with it? Because Moses has them from generations who've preached him in every city, in all the various synagogues. And so Gentiles understand what's in the law of Moses, and they thought of the various laws of Moses as being peculiar to the Gentiles. So here's James' rationale. He says, first of all, we won't require that you keep the law of Moses and be circumcised. Or as it says, therefore, it's my judgment that we do not trouble those who are turning to God from among the Gentiles. However, we will write that we write to them that they abstain from things contaminated by idols and from fornication and from what is strangled and from blood. And then here's the reason. Here's why we will write. For Moses, from ancient generations, has in every city those who preach him, since he is read in the synagogues every Sabbath. It's important, I think, to make this distinction. James is not giving the reason why the Gentiles need to abstain from these things. That is the view that has become so popular. The view that has become so popular is Gentiles need to abstain from these things because there's so many Jews all over the world who find these things abhorrent. And if Gentiles are practicing these things, Jews aren't going to be able to receive them. That same rationale would justify imposing circumcision upon the Gentiles. What James is giving is the reason we need to write to the Gentiles. We need to write these things to the Gentiles because Moses is preached everywhere in all the cities so that the Gentiles, they think of these things as Jewish. And if all we do is send them a letter saying, you don't have to keep the law of Moses, think about the fornicating, idol-worshipping, blood-sucking Gentile who's thinking about becoming a Christian, and he's worried, am I going to have to quit fornicating? Am I going to have to quit worshipping the idol? Am I going to have to quit eating blood? And he's worried about that, and he gets a letter, and all it says is, you don't have to keep the law of Moses. He thinks of these things as being specifically Jewish, and so he says, yippee! I get to keep doing all these things. James says, because Moses has them that preach him everywhere, and all the Gentiles, the implication is, are familiar with all of this, but think of it as Jewish. We need to remind them that even though we're telling them, no, you don't have to keep the law of Moses, there are some things in the law, some things that you think of as Jewish, that as a matter of fact have been forbidden for all men of all time. Don't do those things. So my conclusion is, and I'm done early. No, this is a partial conclusion. God prohibits these things for all men at all times. The prohibitions were essentials. The text says in the letter itself that they write, for it seemed good to the Holy Spirit and to us to lay upon you no greater burden than these essentials that you abstain from these things. The Holy Spirit concurred. It seemed good to the Holy Spirit and to us. And finally, the alternative view, that being the view that these things are not intrinsically wrong, these are really, after all, just Jewish things, and that this was a in a compromise. The prohibitions were really just kind of a request that Gentiles agree to give up these things in order to be able to have fellowship with Jews and be accepted by Jews. That view makes James and the rest out to be hypocrites. Listen to what Peter says. We look at Acts the 15th chapter. And I'm going to go to Acts the 15th chapter here, and I think I want about verse 8. Well, let's skip right down to verse 10, where Peter confronts the believers from among the Pharisees who would impose circumcision in the law of Moses. And Peter says, "Therefore, why make you trial of God, that you should put a yoke upon the neck of the disciples, which neither our fathers nor we were able to bear?" When you go and try to impose these things from the law, you people are making trial of God. Now, we're going to impose some other things on the Gentiles. Well, that would be hypocrisy. And the Holy Spirit would be complicit in it, because the Holy Spirit concurred in this. So no, I do not believe that this is just a compromise because of, as we'll see in a moment, Jews would have a hard time accepting Gentiles if they didn't agree to these things. Well, if that's the case, we need to take a look at the reasons why so many people view the stipulations of the Jerusalem letter as really merely advisory or a request. Please give in to us on these things. F.F. Bruce says the conditions stipulated in the apostolic decree had to do not with the basis of the gospel or the terms of church membership, but with the facilitating of social fellowship between Jewish and Gentile Christians. And he's more precise and clear in another work where he says, if Gentile Christians found that their practices in food matters raised difficulties for the weaker consciences of Jewish Christians, then let them abstain from these practices, not indeed under compulsion, but by their free choice as a gesture of Christian charity. Bruce thought that Gentile acquiescence to these prohibitions was merely a matter of their being charitable because of the weak consciences of the Jews who couldn't understand that it was really all right to do these things. It's kind of interesting that he says, not indeed under compulsion. Because where we have quoted this passage from one translation that uses the word essentials, lay upon you no greater burden than these essentials, Bedag talks about the word translated essentials there and cites one passage in ancient Greek and there translates it compulsory. And yet F.F. Bruce is saying it's not compulsory, but really the text is saying to lay upon you no greater burden than these compulsory things. Weissacher says the decree only imposes on the Gentiles the avoidance of a few things in order to enable the Jews to hold intercourse with them without causing grave offense. Why? Why do they come to this conclusion? Three reasons. One is, I think they are misconstruing James' rationale. When they read James saying, "For Moses from ancient generations has in every city those who preach him, since he is read in the synagogue every Sabbath," they think that this is giving the reason why the Gentiles need to abstain from these things. That is, the Jews are still zealous for the law, and there's Jews everywhere, and they'll be upset if you don't abstain from these things. Secondly, there's a misconstruing of the expression "things sacrificed to idols." It is thought that things sacrificed to idols, eating things sacrificed to idols, is okay. And that's because it is assumed that the expression "things sacrificed to idols" refers to meat sold in the marketplace, leftovers from the temple service. So Calvin had this view. I don't know if this interpretation goes back beyond Calvin, but it goes at least to Calvin, John Calvin. And his argument was that obviously these things are not intrinsically wrong, because you can't take something that's intrinsically wrong and suddenly make it right. And yet, though these things were discouraged in Acts 15, Paul later makes them right. Here's what he said in his commentary on Acts. "But we know that this law was foredone by Paul so soon as the tumult and contention was once ended, when he teacheth that nothing's unclean," Romans 14:14, "and when he grants liberty to eat all manner of meats, yea, even such as were sacrificed to idols," referencing 1 Corinthians 10, verse 25, We will come back to that in a moment, but I want you to notice he uses the phrase sacrifice to idols in connection with 1 Corinthians 10, verse 25. Remember that. Clark, W.K. Lowther Clark, in writing in Theology in 1927, said, "In Corinth, St. Paul felt at liberty to urge the Jerusalem letter's food regulations on the ground of charity only." He's saying the only reason that you need to abstain from these things is just the sense of love for your brother. There's nothing intrinsically wrong with these things, is the idea. Well, then if the warnings of 1 Corinthians 8 are merely advisory against eating things sacrificed to idols, 1 Corinthians 8 through 10, then when you read about things sacrificed to idols in Acts 15 in the Jerusalem letter, they must merely be advisory or a request, but they're not intrinsically wrong. And if eating things sacrificed to idols in the Jerusalem letter is just something that's a request, it's not really talking about something that's intrinsically wrong, what about the other parts of the Jerusalem letter? Well, eating blood. Yeah, actually, they're saying that's really okay. That was an Old Testament thing. Jews are upset with it. So if Gentiles are going to be a part of the church, then they need to kind of acquiesce to the Jews on this, at least for a time. That brings up a problem. It's easy for me to understand how somebody could misunderstand things sacrificed to idols and think that it's really okay to do that. And then maybe to decide that really there's nothing wrong with eating blood and it doesn't matter if you bleed the animal or not. But what do you do with fornication? And this was Calvin's problem. This was John Calvin's problem. And he wrestled with this in his commentary on Acts. And he acknowledged this problem. And he came up with a solution, and just reading between the lines of the way he writes, it looks like even he himself wasn't happy with his solution. But his solution was that, well, fornication here probably means concubines. I'm not sure how that helps him or what he just kind of threw it out there and then moved on after saying this is a real difficult thing. W.K. Lowther Clark offered an explanation in 1927. And his explanation was that the word fornication in Acts 15 does not refer to sexual sin generally. It rather specifically refers to incest. And his passage that he went to establish this, first of all, was 1 Corinthians chapter 5, where you have such fornication is not even known amongst the Gentiles. A man hath his father's wife. And so Clark concluded, aha, it's talking about incest. The word porneia is used. Porneia means incest in 1 Corinthians 5. I want to say two things here. One is that Clark was not looking at this from a purely academic standpoint. He was not merely doing a study of Acts 15, trying to figure out what the Jerusalem letter says. What I'm quoting to you from Clark was in an article he wrote called The Acceptive Clause in St. Matthew. In other words, his real purpose is to try to figure out the exception clause. If a man puts away his wife except for fornication and marries another, he commits adultery. It was in that article where he made this argument. In the outline, I've suggested that perhaps is the origination of this article. I also quote Strock Billerbeck later on in the outline to the same effect. Strock Billerbeck was in German, and I've only looked at it in English quotations, and so I was not aware Strock Billerbeck predates Clark. So Clark is not the original. Whether anybody had it before Strock Billerbeck, I don't know. But as best I can tell, about 100 years ago, this idea that fornication means incest originated. So Clark had it in 27. And so his idea was then in Matthew 19, when Jesus says, whosoever puts away his wife except for fornication and marries another commits adultery, what he really meant was, whosoever puts away his wife except when he finds out she's his sister and marries another commits adultery. And that's kind of trivializing it a little bit. I'm sure he doesn't merely mean that he didn't realize his wife was his sister. But the idea is perhaps a guy doesn't realize he shouldn't have married his sister, and so you just can't divorce. But lo and behold, if you find out your marriage was not a marriage in reality to begin with, because you're married to your sister, and so it's not a marriage, then you can dismiss her, but it's not really a divorce. There's a lot more to say about that. I'm not going to go down that tangent right now. I want to trace the chronology of this just a little bit. Clark in his article then also turned to Leviticus 18 and said, here we've got further evidence. In Leviticus 18, we've got incest described. And Leviticus 17, 18 is the basis for the Jerusalem letter, and therefore, voila, fornication means incest. In 1927, F. Gavin took the same position. 48, a Roman Catholic named Bonservan took the same position. He argued from rabbinic literature, saying he found evidence that marriage is in violation of Leviticus 18, 7 and following. In other words, incestuous relationships were referred to as zinut, the Hebrew word for fornication. And then in 49 or thereabouts, Hawk and Schultz in Theologisches Wörterbuch zum Neuen Testament. I've been practicing that for 2 days. Which is the original German work that was translated into English as the Theological Dictionary of the New Testament. But I wanted to reference the German because I wanted to go back to the date of the German work and trace the chronology of this idea. They take the same position. Roman Catholic H.J. Richards in 59 took the same position. Hanschen in his commentary on Acts in 65 took the same position. Roman Catholic Joseph Fitzmyer does in 76. That's not everybody, but I mention in particular those who are Roman Catholics for this reason. This view that fornication really means incest, and therefore the exception clause in Matthew 19 can be interpreted that way, is most especially popular amongst Catholic theologians. And there's a reason for that. It's Roman Catholic theology that says there is no grounds for divorce whatsoever. Now, we understand the practical reality is if you're a Catholic and you have enough money, you can get it annulled and say it never happened. But setting that aside, the doctrine is there is no exception. There is no grounds for divorce. And so what do you do with the exception clause in Matthew 19:9? Well, you say, aha, it's really talking about he's really married to a sister, so it wasn't a marriage to begin with. And so you can see why this view is popular amongst Roman Catholics. However, among evangelicals now, it's catching on. So Charles Ryrie advocated this view, and F.F. Bruce advocated this view. Fitzmyer appealed to the Dead Sea Scrolls and alleged to find an example of incest an example of zinut, the Hebrew word for fornication, as meaning specifically incest. We'll come back to that in a moment. But the upshot of all of that would be that really they're saying incest is okay, because the premise here is that the Jerusalem letter prohibitions are really about things that are not intrinsically wrong. They're really all right. So we've looked at these three reasons why people come to this conclusion. I've already talked about the James rationale. I want to rebut now the other two, the idea that things sacrificed to idols is really okay, and the idea that fornication means incest. And I want to do that starting with the last one first. What they need in order to make their case, they need to establish that the word porneia, fornication in Greek, and zinut in the Old Testament, the Hebrew, are technical terms or can be technical terms for incest, such that in a passage like Matthew 19:9, where there is no contextual indication whatsoever that we're talking about incest, nonetheless it would be recognized, that's talking about incest. When W.K. Lowther Clark cited 1 Corinthians chapter 5, he doesn't have that. In 1 Corinthians 5:1, the idea of incest, if we want to call it that, is indicated only by the subsequent explanation, and such fornication. There's fornication among you, and such fornication as is not even among the Gentiles, that one of you has his father's wife. It's clear to me, fornication in this passage does not mean merely incest. Fornication here means sexual sin, and there's a particular type of sexual sin that he's addressing here. It can't be a technical term for incest. That's not like Matthew 19:9. It's dependent upon the context for some elaboration to tell you what kind of fornication is in view, because there are many kinds of fornication. The rabbinic literature cited by Bonservan. Bonservan wrote his work in French, and so I have not read his work, but I have read descriptions of his work. And the best that I can tell from his descriptions, it sounds like to me, I suspect we would find the same thing, that he's talking about passages in rabbinic writings where they are talking about sexual immorality, and the specific cases of sexual immorality that they are addressing are cases where somebody has married a close relative, and they're condemning it as a category or as an example of fornication. But that does not prove a technical term whereby the word would be recognized to mean incest apart from some kind of explanation like that, which is what would be needed in Matthew 19. The idea that Leviticus 18 supports the idea that zanut means specifically incest, and therefore that's all that the Jerusalem letter is talking about, that idea seems ludicrous to me. When we look at Leviticus, the 18th chapter, incest is not the only sexual sin mentioned. We have, first of all the different cases of somebody marrying not only a blood relative, sometimes a relative by marriage, but after we have all of that discussion, we have relations with a woman during her menstruation is mentioned. And then after that, we have an odd little verse about sacrificing to Moloch, and that's kind of interesting if you want to discuss that later on. But then after that, it comes right back to the sexual sin, and we have adultery, and we have homosexuality, and we have bestiality described or mentioned. And so you've got a whole host of sexual sins. How do we turn to Leviticus 18 and say, see, there you've got zanut being used as a technical term so that you can just see that word and say, aha, it's incest. As a matter of fact, porneia, the Greek word, used of every kind of unlawful intercourse, or unlawful sexual intercourse, suits the diverse sexual sins in Leviticus 18, all comprehensively. So we look at Leviticus 17 and 18, and when we think of chapter 18 in connection with the Jerusalem letter, we should think of sexual sin, fornication, in its varied forms as being what James has in mind. I want to talk about Fitzmyer's appeal to the Dead Sea Scrolls, where he thinks he finds proof that zanut can be a specialized term just for incest. Remember that the Greek word is porneia, and the Hebrew word is zanut, meaning fornication or sexual immorality or sexual sin. In the Qumran literature, there's a document called Codex Damascus. Codex Damascus was known prior to the discovery of the Qumran literature in another form known as the Zadokite document, the latter part of the 19th century. But then a version of it was found amongst the Qumran literature, and so now it's thought of as part of the Qumran literature. In Codex Damascus, there's a reference to Isaiah 24:7, terror and the pit and the snare are upon you, O inhabitant of the earth. Quotes the passage and then picks up on the idea of the snare. And it's an Essene document whereby the Essenes condemn the orthodoxy of Israel at large, saying they're not really righteous. They are really caught up in a snare. Or the way they say it is, they are caught up in three nets of Belial. And they itemize the three nets. The three nets are zanut, wealth, and defiling the sanctuary. Fitzmyer, in his translation of this and the way he interprets the document, understands it to say that the builders of the wall, so the builders of the wall is kind of a metaphorical reference to some subgroup, and there's a whole lot of discussion as to who the builders of the wall are, but whatever that means, the builders of the wall are trapped in zanut in two ways. There's three nets. One of them is zanut, and the builders of the wall are trapped in that net, the net of zanut, in two ways. Namely, because they take multiple wives, and secondly, because they are guilty of incest. And I'm using the word incest here, technically, but anyway. Marriage to close relations by blood, by marriage, those defined in Leviticus 18. And then the text goes on to say, and they're also guilty of, they're caught in another net, namely defiling the sanctuary, because they have intercourse during menstruation. Is zanut a technical term for incest, and does Fitzmyer's reading of the document, Codex Damascus, support that? Codex Damascus explains how they are caught. If we accept Fitzmyer's translation of it, it explains how they are caught in zanut. They take each one the daughter of his brother and the daughter of his sister, and quotes Leviticus 18, whereas Moses said, you shall not approach your mother's sister, and so on. In other words, it's not an example where you just find zanut and say, aha, incest. The only way you would have any idea is because it extensively describes the kind of zanut, the kind of sexual sin that is in view. That doesn't sound like a technical term that would justify us going to Matthew 19 and seeing nothing in the context that would point to that and saying, aha, it's incest. How can it be a technical term where incest when it also includes polygamy? By Fitzmyer's own translation and interpretation, they are caught in the net of Zanute in two ways: multiple wives and incest. Well, that's not just talking about incest then. If you can argue that it's a technical term for incest there, you could argue it's really a technical term for polygamy. Well, which is it? Can't be both. Well, what it is not a technical term for either. It is really talking about sexual sin, and there's different kinds of sexual sin, and here are the two particulars that are in view. But there's another scholar, Davies, who has translated the text differently. He understands the text to say that the builders of the wall are trapped not in two nets, not in two ways, but in two nets, is how he understands it. He says they're trapped in the net of Zanut, and they're trapped in defiling the sanctuary. And he breaks out the text, understands it, such that Zanut includes the multiple wives, and defiling the sanctuary includes intercourse during menstruation and incest. The point here is that what Fitzmyer's interpretation, his argument, is dependent upon incest being at least included in Zanute. Davies translates the text differently, such that incest isn't even included in Zanute in this document. Well, I don't know how to evaluate who's right or wrong there, but what I do know is even if we take Fitzmyer's argument, it doesn't hold water, and we saw that. So when we go back and look at Leviticus 17 and 18, we have sexual sin of various sorts, which corresponds to the usage that we're familiar with for the word porneia in the New Testament. We should conclude that when the Jerusalem letter refers to fornication, it means sexual sin, just as we think of fornication, including various types. Now let's talk about misconstruing things sacrificed to idols. And we said a moment ago that people think that eating things sacrificed to idols is okay because they think it's talking about meat sold in the marketplace having been left over from the idol temple sacrifice. It's important, I think, to recognize that the expression things sacrificed to idols is one word in Greek. And this is the word eidolathuton. And eidolathuton is easy to see where it comes from. You've got the word idol or image, eidolon, and the word thuo, sacrifice. It's not a phrase that means meat that was or has been sacrificed to idols. It's one word that basically means idol sacrifices. What do we make of that? Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 8 through 10. And keep in mind, this whole section is introduced as being about now concerning things sacrificed, that should say, to idols. And the section is broken out neatly into three chapters with three different points, chapter 8, chapter 9, and chapter 10, or more specifically, chapter 8, 1 through 13, chapter 9, 1 through 23. And really, the point in chapter 10 begins in chapter 9, verse 24, and goes down through chapter 10, verse 22. And then there's another section begins in chapter 10, verse 23 and following. In chapter 8, Paul argues the Corinthians have a problem with a lack of love. They're prideful. They're relying on their knowledge that the idol is nothing, and they're not considering their neighbor. They need to act out of love for others. That's Paul's point in chapter 8. Then in chapter 9, he uses himself as an example, and specifically his foregoing financial income from Corinth. He is considering others, and they need to follow that example in respect to things sacrificed to idols. But then he comes back to it in chapter 10 and hits it head on. He uses Israel as an example, how they were overthrown in the wilderness when they participated in idolatry. And he says, flee from idolatry. And he says outright, you cannot partake of the table of the Lord and of demons. In other words, Paul gives two reasons why what they're doing is wrong. One is they have the wrong attitude. And then he gives himself as an example of a right attitude. And then he gives the second reason that what they're doing is wrong. It's just plain wrong. You can't have fellowship with the Lord and fellowship with demons. You can't have it both ways. You can't do both things. Paul is not saying this is really all right. Just give it up for the sake of somebody else and end of story. He's saying you need to think about others and not justify what you're doing just based on what you think you know. But this is just plain wrong. Then, in chapter 10, verse 23 and following, he starts to discuss meat that is sold in the marketplace. And there, he says, don't worry about it. eat asking no questions. It's almost like an epilogue or an appendix. I've made my point. I've dealt with things, sacrifice idols. Now, there is this related issue. What about when the meat ends up in the marketplace? But I want you to notice the meat in the marketplace is not called edolathuton. That word is not used of the meat that's sold in the marketplace. There is the discussion of what if a pagan invites you to dinner and he tries to attach religious significance to this meat that he's serving you, saying it is hierathuton, which would be temple sacrifice. In his mind, probably little difference. The edolathuton is a word that's really more from the Jewish perspective. Edolathuton is not a word you would find in outside the writings of the Septuagint in the New Testament too much. So this pagan may be trying to make a connection with it. I think of that kind of like you've got some witch or warlock who wants to invite you to his covenant meeting on Halloween, and he says, hey, come to our covenant meeting, and we're going to eat candy in honor of Samhain, the Lord of Death. Would you go? Well, no, don't do that. What if he has some candy left over the next day and you stop by his house? He says, here, have a Snickers. Eat asking no questions. You know what he did with it last night. But what if when you're there the next day, he goes, oh, you're going to really, really appreciate this. You're going to eat this candy that was given in honor to Samhain, the Lord of Death. Now are you going to eat it? Well, no. Paul says, well, don't eat then. But still, the point is, Paul does not refer to the meat sold in the marketplace as a lothaton, as a thing sacrificed to idols. Notice this. In chapter 8, where he's talking about their attitude of a lack of love, he describes the problem as sitting at meat in the idol temple. Whereas in chapter 10, verse 23 and following, the expression is meat in the market. You'll remember it was Calvin who cited 1 Corinthians 10:25 as example of things sacrificed to idols, but it's not called that by Paul. You'll also notice that in chapter 10, Paul is talking about the table of demons. That's not meat in the marketplace. Chapters 8, 9, and 10 up through verse 22 are about things sacrificed to idols, and Paul says that's wrong. Meat sold in the marketplace is another matter, starting in verse 23. So, people misconstrue this thing sacrificed to idols when they say it's really intrinsically all right. And then they go to Acts 15 and say, really all these things in Acts 15, these prohibitions, are not intrinsically wrong. They're misconstruing it. Things sacrificed to idols, that expression, that word, everywhere it occurs in the New Testament, it occurs in conjunction with a condemnation of fornication. The passages are Revelation chapter 2, verse 14, letter to the church at Pergamum. Revelation chapter 2, in verse 20, the letter to the angel of the church at Thyatira. The Jerusalem letter, Acts 15, 29, and where it's referenced again in Acts chapter 21, verse 25. And 1 Corinthians 8 through 10. In two of these, there's an allusion to the Balaam story, where idolatry and fornication were combined. In Revelation chapter 2 and verse 14, I have a few things against you because you have there some that hold the teaching of Balaam, who taught Balak to cast a stumbling block before the children of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idols, and to commit fornication. Is that a reference to leftover sold at the marketplace, leftover meat sold at the marketplace? No. And the fornication there is not incest either. And in 1 Corinthians chapters 8 through 10, where Paul is hammering away at this for three chapters, he goes to the Israelites and talks about their sins as an example of what we ought not to do. Neither be ye idolaters, as there were some of them, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Neither let us commit fornication, as some of them committed and fell in one day 23,000. Numbers 25 is about participation in idolatry. It's not about eating leftovers sold in the marketplace. I think it's interesting and worth noting that the expression in the Septuagint in Numbers chapter 25 is to the sacrifices of the idols of them, or to their idol sacrifices. They call you to the sacrifices of the idols of them. And you can see the thusiais and the eidolon there, the two cognates of the words that make up idol sacrifices. So, in Leviticus chapter 18, we have a lot of sexual sin described as fornication. That's what James is talking about when he talks about fornication in the Jerusalem letter. Let's come to some quick conclusions. I have 5 minutes, right? The Acts 15, here are my conclusions, and we'll debate this, I'm sure. But my conclusions are that the Acts 15 prohibitions are applicable to all peoples of all times. They served as a caveat to the exemption from the law, noting that some things mentioned in the law have always been prohibited to all men. You don't have to keep the law of Moses, but that doesn't mean you're free to do these things that have been prohibited for all men of all time, even though they too, yes, are mentioned in the law of Moses. The issue involving things sacrificed to idols pertains to participation in the idol feast. That's just plain wrong. You can't make that right. The exception clause in the divorce passages is not merely a reference to incest. The only clear New Testament prohibition of incest is the Jerusalem letter interpreted in light of Leviticus 17 and 18. There's some difficulties that I'm left with, and I don't have the answers to these. Sexual relations during a woman's menstrual period. That's included in the list of sexual sins in Leviticus 18. We have kind of trained ourselves to think of fornication as necessarily being something outside of the marriage relationship. How can you commit fornication with your own wife? And yet, James uses the word fornication to summarize all of the sexual sins of Leviticus 18. Among those is this idea that you should not have relations with a woman in her menstrual flow. And it seems this too was part of what God found detestable in the Canaanites. You get to the end of the chapter after you've had all this list of sexual sins. All these things, these abominations are what the people in the land you're going to inhabit have been doing, and that's the reason they're being driven out of the land. We might look at this and say, you know, yes, in principle, the things mentioned in Leviticus 17 and 18 have been forbidden for all people of all time, but the specifics of how those principles were legislated could be unique to the Israelites. So, for example, when he's talking about idolatry in chapter 17, the solution is to bring your offering to the doorway of the tent of meeting. Not all people of all times had to bring their offering to the doorway of the tent of meeting. Idolatry is wrong for all people, but not all people had to bring the offering to the doorway of the tent of meeting. So someone might suppose that we've got some prohibitions against sexual sin and some respect for blood, and for the Israelites, there's a warning against relations during a menstrual flow. I'm not satisfied with that explanation. It's something, though, that I think that we as Christians ought to think about. We ought to give some attention to. If we need to make an application, let's make the application. There are other difficulties, and that has to do with the idea of marriage to a close relative being wrong. When we think about Abraham, faithful Abraham married his half-sister, the daughter of Terah, not the daughter of the same mother, but the daughter of the same father. There are some who argue that that is not in fact the case, that really Sarah corresponds to Iscah, and that actually he married his niece. Whatever that, we still have the problem of marriage between siblings at the beginning. You start out with Adam and Eve, and you get a population. I don't know how you do that unless somewhere along the line somebody married a sister or a mother. So we say, well, that's how it started out, and if it's intrinsically wrong, how do we explain that? Some possible solutions to this problem include the following. Leviticus 18 actually is condemning illicit, that is, non-marital relations between certain relatives, or marital relations between certain relatives following a divorce. But licit marriage in such cases was not condemned by God. So, for example, you could look at Leviticus chapter 18, verse 16, where it includes in the things that are forbidden a man marrying his brother's wife. And yet, of course, later on in Deuteronomy 25, we find that God actually requires them to do just that. That can be solved if we assume that Leviticus 18 is actually talking about not marrying your brother's wife, but sleeping illicitly with her. Kyle and Dalich argue from Leviticus 18:18 that the text condemns, that throughout the text where it's talking about relations between these sexual relations, between these relations, that marriage is in view. And they argue that because in chapter 18, verse 18, it says, "You shall not marry a woman in addition to her sister," or literally take a woman in addition to her sister as a rival while she is alive to uncover her nakedness. you could point to that same fact and say, yes, but that's different than everywhere else in the text there, and argue that the rest of the text is not talking about licit marital relations, but illicit. One may argue, well, that's what I just said. Then there's Abraham's marriage to Sarah again, and we might suppose that, in fact, it was not in accordance with God's will, but was one of those things that God overlooked. I don't know what to make of all of that. Maybe you all do. I am comfortable with the fact that what Leviticus 17 and 18 prohibit or condemn were things that, in principle, God held all men accountable for, and that's the idea behind the Jerusalem letter in Acts chapter 15. Thank you. 1 minute early. I'm done.